This episode of The Interchange is made possible by Absa and Timo.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of The Interchange season 2. We're coming to you from Cliff Central Studios in Johannesburg. I am your host, Busim Kumbuzi. Now, is there such a thing as an enlightened despot in our wonderful continent of Africa? A benevolent dictator, you know, the sort that gets things done rather than the self-serving regimes of the past, which ruled with fear and assassinated opponents. A lot of people agree that authoritarian techniques can actually ensure better results than those realized by clumsy, democratically elected rulers. After all, is democracy even an African system of political leadership? And why uphold it if it doesn't work for us? I'm glad I don't have to be the one answering these questions today. We have four fantastic debaters in studio to enlighten us on the motion. This house supports the narrative that democracy was imposed in Africa and is therefore not the universal solution for African governance. In proposition, I have activist Thato Mokoena and Tumelo Bore, who is a politics student, keen linguist and avid traveler. In opposition, I have Eric Kazadi, who is an environmental management student and Instagrammer, and Bathandwa Mdebele, who is a BA law student and debater. Our episode expert is Dr. Emmanuel Matambo, a researcher from the University of Johannesburg, who holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy and honors in political science, a master's and a doctorate from UKZN. He has published a number of academic articles on a range of issues from conflict resolution, democracy, African agency, to the growing China-Africa relationship. Dr. Matambo, thank you so much for coming in studio.
Thank you very much for your invite.
And, you know, you have a wealth of knowledge specifically on the issue that we're debating today. What would you say your opening thoughts are on democracy and authoritarianism in Africa?
When we talk about democracy and authoritarianism in Africa, we have to look at it from a historical context, first of all, because in the brand of democracy that we adopted after the collapse of the Berlin War in 1989 was out of sheer desperation. Africa was not ready, especially our political leaders were not ready for democracy in its Western brand. So what happened was that the Soviet Union was collapsing. Zimbabwe had just gained independence. South Africa was on its road to getting independence as well. So there was a shift because the Soviet Union was crumbling after Gorbachev became the premier. So because of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, there wasn't much sponsorship that Africa could get from the socialist camp during the Cold War. So our shift towards democracy in its Western sense was out of desperation because we wanted money and we wanted to impress the structural adjustment programs, even if we did not know how to enhance the policies that were argued for by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So our shift, therefore, did not come out of our own volition. It was because we needed money that came with the Bretton Woods Conference. Now, when we talk about authoritarianism on the other hand, it is really an injustice to African history when people say we are not, we do not conform ourselves to democratic ethics because it was not in our brand. People were held to account even back in the day. We had chiefs in Africa, we had kings in Africa, but there was always a revolution whenever a king, for example, was thought to act against the best interests of people. So it is very patronizing for people to think Africans are inured towards authoritarianism and stuff like that. There was always some semblance of accountability. There was what I think they call them Lihotlas or something like that in South African parlance. But those are the elders who were the sages of yonder. Where if a chief, for example, has to make a certain decision, he will consult those people. And those people would consult with the Indunas. The Indunas are people who would now get what exactly is happening on the ground. They would know exactly what the people want. So leaders led, yes, but they led at the invitation of the general populace. Yeah. So it is very condescending for people to think as though Africans are always inured towards an authoritarian type of leadership. So those two things have to be looked at in context. There was some semblance of democracy in the way that democracy is understood. But at the same time, we should not fault democracy as it was adopted in Africa. We should fault the intention behind that adoption. The intention was for us to attract foreign fans, for us to win the favor of the United States, the favor of Britain, the favor of France. It was not because our leaders really believed in the tenets of democracy. So let us, we can blame our leaders and how they adopted democracy, but democracy in and of itself is something that is very laudable, because a leader has to be accountable to the people that he or she leads. It is an ideal political system, but the intention behind us adopting it was out of sheer desperation, and that is where I find a lot of blame.
I mean, I can't wait to hear the sentiments that are going to come through in the debate. Before we get into the debate, a quick rundown of the rules. We are using the British parliamentary format, so we have four debaters and two on each side. The first two are proposition and the last two are opposition. Prop speaker one will go first and op speaker two will go last. Each speaker has 4 minutes to deliver their speech, and in between the first and the last minute, the opposing team may ask points of information. Are we all cool with the rules? Awesome, let's get started. Tato, I'm handing over to you to start the debate. Here.
Thanks. To begin the debate, I think there are two things that I'm going to impose on myself, right? One, I'm going to discuss what the imposition of sort of democracy means, right? And why it sort of benevolent dictators can be a thing that exists, and why they can succeed in a continent like ours, right? So the first thing, I just want to limit democracy to sort of popular participation, right? Participation by the masses, right? And so we don't have to defend, number one, that like Africa would not have chosen that system, right, of just popular participation. But what we see, what we think is imposed, right, is the type of democracy we have, right? When people talk about democracy today, they're talking about liberal democracy. They're talking about independent courts, independent media, and the rights of the individual, right? We think that those things are the things that are imposed. That type of democracy is the thing that is imposed, right? And here's why we think that that's imposed, right? What you need to look at is sort of how democracy develops in the West, right? So it's quite obvious that the continent was dominated and colonized, right?
1 minute up.
Sure. What you need to think about is how it develops, right? It develops from European modernity, right? Which begins with I think, therefore I am. So everything that goes from that point is based on the individual and not on the collective, right? Which is in contrast to democracy, which is popular sort of participation. So what does that mean for Africa? What does it mean, right? It means that when you come to a continent where things like I am because you are, right? Which is a communal sort of doctrine, right? It becomes a crisis when individualism is imposed on those sort of people, right? Because the institutions that they would have built would have been ones that enhanced sort of community and not ones that enhance individualism, right? Which is what we have right now. So how does this all link to sort of dictatorships and, because community often links to coordination, right? And individualism often links to mistrust between individuals, right? If I'm an individual and I'm sovereign, I don't trust that the next person is going to stay true to my sovereignty, right? 1 minute, right? And when we're collective, I have to defend you, because without your existence, I don't exist, right? And that's kind of the institutions that would exist. That's kind of what would go on. Before I go on, Eric.
So the institutions that you like talk about, things like courts, oftentimes set precedents which are beneficial for the community and the entirety of that society. Opening has not really been relevant to the motion.
Okay, sure. Here's where you're missing the point, right? Each court, so sort of courts premise on the fact that the individual is sovereign, right? That's what the thing is. Contrast that with, say, the Khutla, for example, right? Both are systems of arbitration, but the one seeks for a collective solution, the other seeks for justice for the party that has been aggrieved. So even then, you see that the courts sort of prioritize individuals in that regard. But again, how does this link to sort of dictatorships, right? Why dictatorships have not received any backlash is because coordination, right? While they may be repressive, while they may be bad, right? The level of coordination, the level of preservation of community is something that many of these dictatorships have, right? So whether they're wrong and whether they repress their people is a separate discussion from do they preserve the community, and is this what is going on in the minds of Africans? That's what we are arguing today, that they are successful simply because they ratify what people are already thinking outside of the imposition of the radical individualism of a liberal democracy.
All right, thank you so much for that speech, Thato. I'm now going to hand over to the first opposition speaker to rebut your case. Here, Eric.
So thank you for that. So what we are going to tell you in opposition is that, firstly, the African people want a form of democracy because for far too long have they been oppressed, and it's something that it's an innate desire. But secondly, within the debate is about beyond whether or not it was imposed. The debate is specific about the narrative of that imposition. So we think the support of the narrative is something that's going to lead to worser leaders. But thirdly, we'll even question the idea of benevolence and whether or not an individual that has authoritarian rule and total rule can even be benevolent at the end of the day. Before that, a few points of rebuttal. So firstly, we aren't really clear what the proposition stance is, right? We think a lot of the P1 speech is talking about things like philosophical things and not necessarily linking it directly to the motion at hand. But what we take away is the fact that African communities are based on the ideas of, let's say, Ubuntu, right, where it's looking out for the other and having that collective identity. We think that that's not mutually exclusive from democracies. For example, in democracies, we allow for things like tribal courts. During the Rwandan genocide, we had tribunals and things like that. So we are able to encompass these individual identity, collective identity things that he wants in a democratic system. What he had to argue was why, given that they can be incorporated, why then is it still better that we have a benevolent dictator over someone who is voted in, someone who has to be representative of the larger demographics, and someone whose mandate is to preserve all identities, right? Oftentimes, things that are based on one community only have a mandate to that community. Democracy is unique in that it oftentimes exists across tribal lines, or at least it should exist across those kinds of identity lines. So what is more relevant from that speech is the idea about how they preserve communities and therefore are successful as dictators, and they preserve the being of individuals. This is something that I deal with when I talk about, are they actually benevolent at the end of the day? So onto the first argument of opposition on why people actually want it. In Africa, we have a history of colonization, but post-colonization, we have a history of very strong armed military leaders, your Mobutu Sese Sekos, your Idi Amin. We think these are individuals that have for far too long oppressed the African voices and African and what the African people want. So we think that it's a natural progression that Africans would desire democracy because at least it gives them a say at the end of the day. We can't now trust that an individual will suddenly be benevolent towards them. Secondly, though, the narrative itself is problematic because when we have the narrative that it was imposed, it's likely to lead to leaders who have no obligation or don't even try to uphold other individuals and uphold some sort of democratic principles. We think that this is what leads to things like press suppression. This is what leads to the suppression of opposition rulers and things of opposition leaders, rather, because the idea is democracy is a foreign concept and therefore I have no obligation towards upholding it. But lastly, are they actually benevolent at the end of the day? Individuals like Paul Kagame have a history that has been unraveled of oppressing opposition leaders, of exiling journalists that critic them. We think that benevolence, sure, they do uphold the economy, but we think economic development without substantial development of the people on the ground is something that we should be against, because it's not enough to have greater standards of living if you can't fully express yourself and express those identities that they speak of on proposition as an individual. So largely, we think that there's a huge work that needs to be done by Tumelo, but beyond that, they still haven't shown us why benevolent dictators are likely to be better for the people on the ground than a system of democracy which allows for them to participate and engage with the people in power.
Thank you so much for that speech, Eric. I'm going to give over to the prop speaker to conclude the proposition case here.
Okay, I think as a point of departure, we ought to discuss this idea that Eric speaks about when he says democracy as a foreign concept, because democracy in and of itself, if you look all over the world, is something that's very much tailored to the context in which it exists. Now, the question that we then have to ask is that have Africans been allowed to tailor the democracy according to their interest? We think this is fundamentally not true, based on the fact that if you look at the history of Africa being a colonized, countries in Africa being colonized, right, the colonizer then has much of and more authority in dictating and detailing
revealing the type of state and how the state apparatus ought to work in terms of governance, right? And this is something that you as the colonized think this is something that we ought aspire to, and this then augments your view of democracy. We think this is fundamentally problematic in terms of how democracy should orient itself around the context in which it exists. We think this is particularly important because that mindset is that what is one that speaks to a liberal democracy, which Tut already alludes to, then it focuses itself on individualism as individualism as the most important crux of that democracy. We think as Africans,
1 minute up.
I think as Africans, the most important thing and the best way for us to develop as a society and form of governance, not yet, right, is the fact that we have to speak to the concept and the principles of Ubuntu, because this is something that is inherently African and we need to tailor democracy to ourselves. Moreover, Eric wants us to do this comparative, right, on how benevolent dictators don't necessarily exist, or if they did, how they're comparatively better, right? And in doing so, there's a couple of examples that we can use, right, whether it be the strongman politicians or the Paul Kagames of the world. Let's look at what's necessarily, who is living a better life in Africa? If we're going to compare Yoweri Museveni's Uganda and how the Ugandan people are living as in comparison to Paul Kagame's Rwanda, right, which has one of the fastest growing economies, which then has people on the ground are living better lives because having economic stability allows these people to have mobility, right? And that type of mobility allows for them to give their children a better life. But before I carry on, that man disagrees.
Yes, I disagree because the mobility means nothing at the point at which you aren't able to fully be expressive. So we think South Africa, which has democracy, is still comparatively better than both these strong armed dictators we talk about.
No, but at the point, that's not necessarily true, right? Because at the point at which you have, in essence, the capacity to question your government because you have the mobility to interact with them. If you're a poor person, right? For instance, if you're a poor person, poor people don't have that type of agency or confidence to question their governance. But once you have a foothold in that state, once you have certain services that are provided for you and you feel like you have a certain solid income, then you feel like you are more likely and more able to, in essence, challenge these systems. The same reason why in South Africa, as a comparative, the people like the black middle class, often terms referred to as the clever blacks, oftentimes are more critical of the ANC as opposed to the people who exist in rural areas. We think that comparison directly shows you how economics has a large part to play in whether people can be and are able to question the type of governments that exist. We think that's particularly important, right? Moreover, what necessarily happens if you look at Yoweri Museveni's Uganda is that people are far more brutalized, right? And we think at the point at which you think that African people are important, you have to then value the lives that they're living and the type of human rights injustices they're going through. And at that point, we think on the comparative, what is better, not necessarily the best thing, but what is better is Paul Kagame's Rwanda. And we think that's particularly important. So when we tell you the fact that we ought to regret these type of democracies, we're speaking specifically to these liberal democracies because inherently they aren't African. They are something that we aspire to, that we ought not aspire to, because it's something that we should decolonize in our identities in and of itself and tailor fit democracy to ourselves. We think that's particularly important. And we tell you that as proposition, we've already proven to you on the comparative what is better for the African. So if you value the African, we think that the benevolent dictators are far better.
Thank you so much for that speech, Tumelo. And to conclude the opposition case and the debate in general, here, Batandwa.
Okay, so what we're mostly getting from the proposition side is this focus on the fact that we need to tailor democracy to suit what the African people want, right? So the question that then comes to mind is then, in what kind of state are you actually going to be able to tailor democracy? Is it going to better occur in a state where there is a dictator as a leader, or is it going to occur in a state where actually the leader has been elected democratically and is not a dictator, right? Where are we going to get this tailorization of democracy to suit what the African people want? What we argue from outside is that firstly, what is better for the African people themselves is for them to choose the type of democracy that they want to exist in, and that doesn't happen when we have these benevolent dictators, right? So Eric touched on this idea of the fact that we don't think that there is a world where a benevolent dictator can exist, right? Firstly, proposition didn't really quite show how and why they think that a benevolent dictator exists, because what we think from outside of the house is that the fact that a person is a dictator is that even though that they're doing good and that the economy is thriving and the people are doing well, the fact that people are still suppressed within their communities, within their country, that is not good for them in and of itself because of the like quality of life that we're actually creating for these people, right? Because you can't argue and make the comparison of the fact that in South Africa, when you are part of the black middle class, you're able to question the government, right? Because in South Africa, there is free speech. Within Uganda, there is no free speech. So even if I'm economically like able and stable and like I'm financially like stable, you're still not able to question that government. You still have to like work within the bounds that have been created for you. So you aren't actually enjoying democracy to its fullest extent. But now let's move on to questioning what they really mean by this whole idea of the fact that focusing more on like what it means for us to say that we don't support the narrative that it's been democracy has been imposed on Africa, right? First thing that we argue here is that it hasn't been imposed on Africa. Firstly, people like in the way in which like Africa has developed in itself is that democracy, like the will of the people to want to rule themselves, is innate to being human, not because the fact that it comes from like the West can't then be like the argument that it's been imposed. Further, for us to say that it's been imposed lends itself to the fact that African people don't think freely and that they don't choose to actually like accept some kind of like concepts that they think are relevant to them as a people, right? So why is it not okay for Africans to look at something that the West has come up with and be okay with it and want to actually exercise it within their own lives, right? No, not yet, right? Further, we think that the fact that if you look at these dictatorships and how like elections occur within those countries, like if you look at Rwanda, right? When you look at that country, the fact that the dictators themselves have to rig elections, they don't do away with the elections, right? Because people still want that feel of I'm actually choosing who's going to be my leader, right? That in and of itself shows us that there's this will and want from the people to live within a democratic state, right? So we think that because of that, it's like extremely problematic for us to argue that to argue the fact that democracy has been imposed on Africa, right? And also, if we look at, we can't in any world argue that it's okay for us to accept the suppression of people in any kind of state just because it's better for them economically, right? So, like, what cost are we willing to go to in terms of trying to attain this economic freedom, right? Further, it's not like you cannot be economically stable and financially like free. It's not like it only occurs in a state with a dictator, right? It can occur through other means. So why are we then willing to accept all the negatives that come with a dictatorship, when there are other options of actually like creating some kind of stability for the African community, right? For the last thing that I'd like to look at is this whole idea of the fact that the individual and like the liberal participation
and
that people.
Unfortunately, your time is up.
Okay,
4 minutes. Dr. Matsambo, a heated debate, I'm sure you'll agree. And I think the big clash that we have here is the idea of individual freedom being an end in itself, which is a core tenet of liberal democracy, versus the idea that individual freedom exists to serve the state. How would you help us untangle this clash in terms of moving forward with this debate?
First of all, I should congratulate the four speakers. All of them gave very reasonable and sound arguments. And then we have to realize that as Africans, because we still lag behind in terms of economic development, so this debate is not just intellectual. Mm. It is something that is also emotional, because it tackles the very existence of Africa and the prospects for progress. Now, when you look at Africa and the countries that have really developed in Africa, a lot of people would, especially when you're talking about this, the whole concepts of benevolent dictatorship and stuff like that, the first thing that will spring to mind in a lot of African minds is Paul Kagame and what he has done in Rwanda in the last 25 years. Well, it cannot begin said that Rwanda has made a lot of strides in terms of its economic progress. But then let us look at maybe the concepts of growth itself, and then we look at development.
Mm.
What has happened in Rwanda is something that has happened in Singapore, the four Asian tigers. Mm. Talk about Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, and Taiwan. So what those countries have achieved is economic growth and economic progress.
Mm.
But whether or not it is development, that is another fact.
Mm.
Because I will look at it from, I'll look at development as something that is human-centered. You can note, for example, give someone money, provide them for a job, give them a good education, but at the same time, steal from them their liberties.
Yeah.
They want to live a free life where a lot of people, for example, who argue for benevolent dictatorship will look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where, you know, you first start with survival and then self-actualization comes at the end. But then people at the end of the day would want to have a say, not only on who provides them food, but then they would want to have a say as well on their life. How do you live your lifestyle? When China, for example, in 1978, embarked on its full modernization program and its reform and opening up policy by Deng Xiaoping, Deng Xiaoping was very firm in saying, we are going to embark on a trajectory of economic development, but we were not going to liberalize politics in the Western sense.
Mm.
Because remember, they had just opened up, China had just signed its diplomatic relations with the United States. Mm. But still, it could not be won over to the United States. Because there is a difference in how how the Western world looks at politics and how the Eastern world, especially China, looks at politics. In the United States and in Britain, they look at the government as an intrusive aspect of human life.
Yeah.
So it is something that intrudes on people's private lives. That is why there is that disconnect. But if you look at China, for example, when I was in China about 2 weeks ago, they look at the state as an extension of the family, so to say.
Mm.
So you cannot revolt against your family.
Mm.
So that is how they look at it.
Mm.
Because if you look at the Confucian ideology, the Confucian ideology of governance is that once you are a leader, you get what in China they call the mandate of heaven.
Mm.
You are more or less appointed by divine fiat, so to say. So if you are appointed by divine fiat, then that means people cannot rebel against you. But then that is the trajectory that China set itself up in 1978. And it worked, economically speaking. But was it developmental in the sense that it respected people's liberties? It did not.
Mm.
In 1989, for example, there was the Tiananmen Square, the June 4 incident, as it is called, where some people say thousands of protesters were killed because Chinese students wanted democracy. They did not only want economic progress. They wanted democracy. They wanted to have a direct say on who rules the country.
Mm.
When that happened, George Bush the first, the senior, actually predicted that, okay, now this is the fall of authoritarianism in China. But it wasn't. They were told, no, we're going to take these political liberties from you, but we are going to give you economic progress.
Yeah.
And for about 40 years, China sustained an economic growth average of about 9.5% growth. The same thing is happening in Rwanda as well, where you have economic progress. Now they have what they call conference tourism.
Mm.
A lot of people will go to Rwanda. I think it has the fastest Wi-Fi in Africa, if I'm not mistaken. So there is some semblance of progress being shown on at an economic front. But whether or not it is developmental is a subject for debate.
Mm.
And I would first of all advise our debaters, especially, to read Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man in his defense for the French Revolution. Because Edmund Burke had just written Reflections on the French Revolution because he was against a revolution that was so violent. But that rupture had to happen for people to win their democratic rights.
Mm.
The French monarch was a system that was working against the basic liberties of people.
Mm.
So people were within their rights to rise against that.
Mm.
So in defense of that, Thomas Paine talks eloquently, actually, about why people have the right to rise against dictatorial governments.
Yeah.
So here in Africa, we see what happened in Mauritius, we see what happened in Rwanda. Yes, economically speaking, those were really progressive governments, but they were not people-centered, and that is the problem.
Yes.
That is why you have a situation where Paul Kagame has the arrogance of saying, no, if you turn your back against Rwanda, don't expect not to suffer the consequences.
Mm.
And he justified that because he was physically liquidating people who are opponents to his government. So we need economic progress in Africa, but at what cost?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
The Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, in his book From Third World to First, that is another book that maybe people would find useful as well. He talks about how Singapore had to prioritize certain things. For example, it is an, of course, it is a very small country. It is a city country. It's It was threatened by the existence of Malaysia right from the beginning in the early 1960s. So he actually admits himself, did we have to jail certain people for us to make sure that we are not deviated from our economic path? Yes, they had to do that. But then at what cost did that come? That is the basic question that we should all be asking ourselves. So it is well and good to have economic progress, but let us make sure that whatever progress that we make, we have people as the cynosure, as the center of attention. Yes, give me money, give me a proper job, give me a proper school, but at the end of the day, give me freedom to also speak on who exactly is my leader. What liberties do I have? So that is where the Western world actually becomes kind of better than the Eastern world.
Yes. Sure. I'm going to throw it to our debaters now. I'll throw a couple of questions at them, specifically at some of the things that you have spoken to.
Like, if someone's just sitting at home listening and they've heard all kinds of rhetoric-based arguments about what democracy is and how it came about in Africa and the future of democracy in Africa, how do we even define it in a way that makes sense for them to make their own decisions from a debate such as this?
I can answer that. I think popular participation, right? Can you participate? Can you have a view in the generals, how your society goes, right? Can you direct where your society goes, where it doesn't go, right? Do you have a voice, right? Is what democracy is, right? And elections, right? Elections are an arrangement. They are the institutionalization of you giving your voice.
Okay.
Right. And so democracy is constantly having that voice to be able to speak out and say, this is where I think we should be going.
And the alternative to democracy, is it necessarily authoritarianism? Because I remember in season one, episode one, Mpilo Ndlovu talks about the alternative to democracy, and she makes such a good argument that people leave the room thinking, as problematic as democracy is, throwing it away, you know, could create worse outcomes for individual freedom. So is there a spectrum? You know, or can authoritarianism also exist within the context where this voice is still allowed to exist, to flourish, and is potentially institutionalized in systems?
I mean, along that spectrum, for me, what I think is what you would get, the kind of authoritarianism that should allow for that participation or to be a benevolent dictator.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, it's still a leader who has the final say, so they aren't bound by what the people think. They aren't bound to implement the things that the people support, but oftentimes at the end of the day, they're also the ones who condition the society to be basically an echo chamber of themselves, right?
Mm.
So countries where benevolent dictators have been sort of successful, like oftentimes are Asian countries like Singapore, to some extent China, and these are where the individuals are socially engineered to think that the leader is also right. So then it becomes a question of, is it actually their voice, or has the campaigning and the backdrop
propaganda
of that been so strong that it has changed them to just be puppets at the end of the day?
Yeah, because if you look at fascism, the whole idea is that the individual exists to serve the state. And a dictator promotes a very extreme brand of nationalism using propaganda to maintain a hold on the people. So it is a very real question to ask, is this the people's voice, or is this an echo chamber? But, you know, Tumelo, in the Pop case, you guys advocate for this authoritarian figure within the African context, you know, coming into the picture. Why?
Well, if you kind of look at Africa as a continent and how we ought to develop Africa, you have to look at, like, democratic terms of presidents.
Uh-huh.
They're very short, and that type of development that Africans need has to be something that is a long-term thing that is sustainable, right? And we think if you have, like, for instance, you have, like, two presidents in, like, a span of 10 years, two presidents want to achieve completely two different things, then you have two things, like, one thing that is done half, another thing that's done half,
okay.
No real development for the people on the ground.
Mm.
So we think as a prioritization of Africa as a whole, it's, like, the same way with Singapore, right? The type of like long-term development that they had that kind of allowed for them to kind of ascend. We think that's...
Wouldn't you agree that you know, we only want the sort of solution because we're in hard times? Because, you know, in hard times, people are willing to go along and support many, many different things that aren't necessarily things that they would pursue if they were going through good times. And for us to accept the political system, surely it would need to work regardless of whether we were developed or developing. In which case, I guess the question is, even would you say, you know, that principally a dictatorship makes sense, even in a developed context?
I don't know. So
the tough questions.
Yeah, it's about the ethic, right? Which is why I kind of spoke about liberal and collective, right? Is that the ethic determines what you do. For example, right, when no matter how developed, no matter how rich or poor you are, you will always take care of your children because that's the ethic you have, right? I need to take care of my. Imagine if that ethic is expanded to all of society, right? No matter how rich or poor I am, I need to take care of my society, of my community, right? That's not necessarily like fascism or whatever, but like the ethic is something that is separate from democracy, I think. I think individual liberty is a separate concept from democracy, and you can, and so, yeah.
Okay, but why would a dictator allow for individual freedom or any kind of process of democratic decision making? Because by definition, a dictatorship is authoritarian.
Not necessarily, right? You have things called illiberal democracies where you have a court, you have a relatively free media, but what happens is there's so much engagement between the courts and the executive that like all their actions look coordinated, right? And so that's illiberal because the fact that the executive can talk to the court so many times is something that a liberal order would shy away from. It's like, no, leave the Chief Justice alone, right? Chief Justice, leave the President alone, right? And that kind of suspicion is the ethic of liberalism, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm saying that if you remove the ethic of individualism, you might find yourself in a situation where you have democracy that doesn't sort of prioritize the sovereignty of the individual, but prioritizes a sort of coordinated movement forward of society. Yeah.
And I mean, as opposition, Batando and Eric, one of the reasons you guys have such a huge issue with this is because you don't want to bet the future of the continent just on one example, you know, Rwanda achieving a remarkably clean and efficient government. But why shouldn't we? Why shouldn't we? I mean, if we look at political studies in general, we base our decisions based off of the best models that have worked. And in the African context, there is a model and it has worked. So why not?
I think even if we can argue that that's like a model that has worked in terms of what's happening in Rwanda, I think at the point where people are still suppressed in some kind of way, it's not a perfect model, right? Because this is something that we kind of like spoke to within our speeches, that it's not just enough for us to be like happy and praise that there's been economic development and improvement, right? That's not the be all and end all of what people want for themselves and what they want for their lives. So at the point where people are still questioning that this is not the kind of system that we want to live in, then we should still look for a different system, which is people are lending themselves towards democracy. And I kind of wanted to touch on what Dumelo said of the fact that like the turnover of leaders is too fast within like a democratic state, and you aren't then able to like put in policies into place to ensure that to allow those policies to develop to the point where they actually make changes, right? So, like, even if we then argue that there should be a sort of extension of the terms of presidents, right? That we don't want it to be 5 years, we want it to be at least 10 years, so you at least have enough time to actually make actual changes. The fact that there's still some kind of limit then means that there's pressure on those leaders to perform, and that they aren't just there, like, I can just do what I want to do because no one is going to drive me out. But immediately when we remove those like barriers of terms and those limitations, we then fall into a trap of like basically being at the mercy of that dictator and whatever they want to do.
Well, I'm going to ask all of you to give me your real personal opinion on this issue. Assuming you had the power to sway a rally to support a specific view on the day before a important election or important meeting with the president of any African country, what would you say?
So personally, I am a proponent of liberalism and liberal democracies. I think the sacrifices that a benevolent dictator would ask of the people is a tall order. So like in Singapore, for example, 25% of your monthly income has to be put away for like state usage into like building roads and all of those things. So that's a valuable and like admirable outcome that would result. It just requires a lot from you as an individual, and because of that, it would also require a lot of propaganda to make individuals submissive towards that. I think liberalism and letting the people like do not anarchy, but like having some sort of autonomy over themselves is something that is valuable at the end of the day.
Sure. Tomato?
Though I think like Erica's got a point, right? That like individual liberties are something that we ought to aspire to have, something that we should try and preserve. At the same time, look at, like, it has to be very contextual when you answer this question, like where you are, because we aren't in Asia, we aren't in America, and also have to understand the fact that there's no such thing as a perfect democracy. Every democracy is flawed, and in some, to some, like, in which extent, like, there's always an extent to which your individual liberties will always be suppressed, wherever it is, whether it's be like the oldest democracy, whether it be like the US, UK, whatever. So my thing is, I think the most important thing for Africa right now, specifically if we're going into like towards this train of like decolonization and we're trying to like make Africa one of like the large contenders in the world, it has to be on development. And in that case, I don't necessarily think that like this like liberal democracy is the best case for development in Africa.
Yeah, I would say radical democracy. I subject unfortunately some of your will to the greater good, right? And what that means is high taxes are fine to the extent that we're paying for people's meals. So yeah, I think that one of the thing that I would say is to any leader, right, is that democracy, right, no dictatorships, not at all, right, but democracy everywhere, no boss who runs an institution that we run by themselves, right, no one with any sort of sovereign power over themselves and over others. That's it.
Sure.
That's basically it. Also, like, in line with what I think, just autonomy is extremely important. So whatever people want in terms, and like, should they should be allowed to exercise themselves like freely, right? And the best model that we can achieve that in, even if it is flawed, is within a democratic model. And that even if we can argue that in terms of practicality and development is slower than the other systems, like, you would rather be in a system that if even if it took you longer to get there, you get to a better form of life, opposed to just accepting something for the now and like still living basically in a state that isn't satisfying and not in a way that you want to live, right? So I think because of that, I'd still lean towards like democratic rule.
Now, Dr. Mutombo, I think the sentiment that has been covered throughout this debate and even in this post-debate session is that Africa is desperate for change, and Africans want their livelihoods to be secured. But you said this yourself in your opening, that economic progress does not have to come at the expense of individual liberties. So if you were to give, you know, the listener a takeaway in terms of how do we build political systems that are both progressive but also protect our liberties and give us, you know, the full benefit of our rights, you know, as Eric has kept mentioning and rehashing in this debate, what would you say, you know, how would you say we need to reimagine our political system?
We can reimagine our political system by what I usually call a bottom-up approach, because we have noted in Africa that if we have to leave our governments to do our bidding, then we're in for a disaster, because we have seen that our economic and political system in Africa is susceptible. Why? Because our leaders do things out of desperation. In 1989, we said, okay, we are done now with the East. We are going to embrace liberal democracy. What happened now after 2008? The prospects for capitalism and its success were kind of dwindling, and now all of a sudden, the Eastern option is seen as an resort. So the problem that we have is just that, the lack of principle. We don't know, our leaders do not know exactly where they want to take the continent. All they want to do is, we are just going to bend our will towards whoever is giving us the money. And that is a problem that we have. The Chinese are coming to Africa, but they know exactly what they want. The United States knows exactly what it wants. Does Africa know what it wants? I don't think our leaders for now, as from what we have witnessed historically, know exactly what they want. So what we need as Africans actually is a bottom-up approach, where citizens, especially ordinary citizens, through the power of the ballot, through education, they try in as much as they can to revolutionize the continent, because we cannot rely on our political leaders. They have repeatedly let us down. So let us, from the grassroots, embark on a system that will support democracy, but at the end of the day as well, is going to sustain economic progress. But let us do it as citizens. Let us not just relinquish our responsibility to the government.
Sweet and short. I think nothing more needs to be said beyond that idea of bottom-up renewal. And if you know me, you know I'm a huge advocate for change coming directly from the citizens. Personal agency is going to become more important than ever in redefining our political trajectory as a continent. Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Interchange. We hope that you enjoyed it. Send us your comments, share, make sure that we know your views. But most importantly, how are you going to use your agency to redefine our future?
This was another thought-provoking debate made possible by APSA and Simung, amplifying the voices of young people. The Interchange, seeing Africa through a youthful lens.